Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by Joe Drape, who is a sports writer, but he has a book out, a new book called The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. This book is available now, and it's just a fantastic read. Joe, what I'm always amazed at with authors who write nonfiction, you cover sports, and now you're writing a book about saints. A lot of nonfiction writers will come upon a book that's out of their comfort zone necessarily by a little nugget that they discover while they're researching something else. That's kind of what happened to you in Kansas, isn't it?
Yeah, it did. I was in 2008, I moved my family to Smith Center, Kansas to write about their undefeated football team in a book called Our Boys. And what got me out there was a Times story I did on them, and they had two rules: love one another and let's get better every day. So I moved to rural Kansas, and this is where I was introduced to Father Emil Capon. And he is a would-be saint. Now they're trying to make him a saint in the Catholic Church. But more important than that, he was a Kansas farm boy who came from that region, who found his true calling as a chaplain in the military. In fact, he's the most decorated chaplain in military history, and won the Bronze Star in World War II, and eventually was awarded the Medal of Honor in 2013 by President Obama for his heroics in the Korean War. And, you know, he had this brilliant, remarkable life, short life. He died in a prisoner of war camp at the age of 35 in 1951. So, you know, I heard about it from the people that I was there reporting on something else. Fast forward 7 years later, and with an editor who had done another book with me, and he said, have you thought about doing anything outside sports? And boom, that just popped in my head. And so, you know, I do think there was a little divine providence in there, that a nugget was planted by God or the higher power in 2008. The opportunity arose in 2015. And, you know, the next 5 years I've spent you know, chronicling this remarkable life, looking at the church, which I grew up in, parochial and Jesuit educated, but I didn't even know how a saint was made. And more importantly, it sort of prodded me to take inventory of my spirituality, and that's a great byproduct out of this.
What I thought was interesting is how a priest from Kansas becomes a military chaplain. Why was that his assignment at the time? Because it seems out of the ordinary for those of us that are Catholics today.
You know, because he wasn't a very good parish priest, Brian. You know, bright guy, well thought of, but they made the mistake of sending him back to his hometown, Pilsen, Kansas, to be the pastor there at the church he grew up in as an altar boy. And the community didn't embrace him because they still thought of him as, you know, Emil and Bessie's boy. So he was struggling there. He got a perchance assignment to be just the assistant chaplain at a nearby military base. And he was a young man of these guys' age, you know, in his 20s. He was a physical specimen. He liked doing the training, the exercises. He found men he could relate to, and you know, that's really where he found himself. And he bucked. They tried to bring him back a couple times, and he did do as he was told, but as soon as the wars broke out, he was the first guy in line to go over there.
This whole idea of making him a saint, this isn't an easy process. And when I first read a book, or when I first saw that you'd written a book about making somebody a saint or how the process is, I thought, oh my gosh, that's kind of finding out how you make sausage. Because those of us in the church like to think that it is this distinguished process and there's just no pitfalls. But this is as highly a political process as anything, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very political process, and it takes money and time. I mean, the average elapsed time from death to canonization is 181 years. It's expensive. They've already got $600,000 into Father Capon's candidacy, some top a million easily. And, you know, there's a little supernatural element. You've got to prove miracles, and, you know, miracles in the Catholic Church, you need two of them. And the way they're judged is it has to be a remarkable recovery from death or near death that medicine and science doesn't explain. And more importantly, that recovery took place because your friends, your family, your community, your parish prayed to, in this case, Father Capone, and asked him to intercede on their loved one's behalf. And that proves he's in heaven next to God and has the pull to make it happen. So, you know, it was Byzantine. It has evolved over the centuries. And, you know, as a Catholic, you refer to yourself, you know, we're an old church. We're centuries old. You know, we don't change very quickly. In the beginning, there's about 10,000 saints. In the beginning, it was just a voice vote. If me and you decided Bill, our neighbor, was a man of holiness, we'd call him a saint, and that would be passed down. And, you know, some of our most famous saints never really existed. Saint Christopher, the patron saint of travel, is really a legend. He was a giant who lived next to a river, and his job was to carry people across it. One day he carries a small boy over, almost drowns. It was the most arduous journey he ever had. And he puts the boy down, and the boy says, you know, I'm Christ. You carried heaven, earth, my church, and all the hopes of civilization. That's why it was so hard. But, you know, that is legend. So in the 1500s, they decided to, Vatican and the Pope said, we need to put a little discipline and regimen in this. And they put up this first set of rules that called for four miracles, and you couldn't be considered a saint until 50 years after your death. And it has evolved in time since then to really a very smart marketing tool of, you know, making saints the Catholic Church's superheroes. And for that, we have to thank John Paul II, the Pope, who made 482 saints in his tenure, and that was more than all his predecessors put together.
And speaking of marketing, Pope John Paul II used this as a marketing tool when he would travel, because he was one of he was the most traveled pope of all, right?
Yeah, and he would literally call over the congregation for the causes of saints and say, you know, I'm going to South America. Who do we have in the pipeline over there? And, you know, there's causes bubbling up all the time, and causes for your non-Catholic listeners are would-be saints. You know, think of it as a political campaign, people running for the office of sainthood, and they're coming from all over the world. And he saw this as a way to meet people where they live, to give, you know, he says it very eloquently. There's not only a saint is somebody who's led a life of virtue and is worth imitating, but they've got to be relatable. We got to see ourselves in them. And, you know, that's what he would do when he'd travel. He'd find the causes, and if it was a chance to canonize, he'd do it. If it was a chance to beatify, he would do it. And beatify is the doorstep of sainthood. That means one miracle you're involved with has been approved. So, you know, it was really sort of savvy strategy. And I think it kept the you know, as a news guy, it kept the Catholic Church in the news all over the world.
Chatting with Joe Drape about his new book, The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. This book, Joe, also tells the story of another priest in Kansas, Father John Hotz, who is really the champion for Father Capone's sainthood. And can you kind of explain what Father Hotz had to do to get this together? Because it sounded like just a tremendous amount of work. And I kept trying to pinpoint the incentive that the particular diocese has. I mean, I don't know what remuneration they get from having a saint out of their diocese, but can you address how Father Hotz's work is on behalf of the diocese there?
Yeah, Father John was the guy who was appointed in 2000 to pick up the cause and, like, make it a real candidacy. He had been, Father Capone had been called a servant of God in 1993, had the first step, and the military chaplaincy started, but it just sort of kind of puttered along. So what Father John did was spent better part of his adult life, 15 years or so, researching everything he could about Father Capone, and he did such an excellent job that he compiled 8,262 pages of documents and testimony and sermons of Father Capone's life from cradle to grave. And with that, they were able to get a canon lawyer in Rome and put it into what they call a posicio, which is really a narrative. And that is the next step of opening the cause, of saying, okay, this is a man of virtue. And, you know, to your question of what's the value of being a saint from Wichita, Father John grew up praying to this guy. And it's just like the people from Kansas that I had first told me about him. This was somebody homegrown you could be proud of. And these causes are really grassroots efforts. I mean, and again, that's that relatability, is if this guy who grew up on a farm like I did could go be a hero in Korea and live this life of virtue, you know, I can, if I can't do that, I can try to do that and make the world a better place.
There's a scene in the book that I absolutely loved. It's when you were in Rome and you were starting your research. You essentially showed up and spoke to someone in charge at the Vatican as to and tried to ask questions about it. Can you describe that scene? Because the way you describe it in the book, I chuckled a couple of times because it was a very contentious scene.
Monsignor Robert Sarno is the American's man in the Vatican, in the congregation. And I had been told that he is very knowledgeable, but he was very rule stickler, answered his own phone, but needed to go through official channels. And, you know, I didn't go through the official channels, but he was there to see me anyway. And, you know, he is a well-meaning guy, and he's very good at what he does. But to me, he sort of was the epitome of the bureaucracy. You know, it was like, you know, and my kind of takeaway from the whole time I spent in the Vatican is it's just like the Pentagon or an insurance office. It's, you know, it's a bureaucracy, except they wear collars and black. And, you know, Monsignor Sarno didn't want to acknowledge that politics and demographics played a part of the decision making. You know, he kind of wanted to be the old school guy that said this is a mysterious thing that only prayers answer. And, you know, he was forthcoming, but not as forthcoming as he could have been. And I just kind of wanted to convey that it takes, you know, there is an element to the church that rubs people the wrong way, including me, and it's sort of this officialness, and arrogance is too hard a word, but, you know, sort of the all-powerful. And I do think, and I talk about this in the book, as you know, I think the church shoots itself in the foot a lot by not being more inclusive and not being more down-to-earth, more compassionate. And part of that is just the history of the church. It's a century-old bureaucracy run by men. And, you know, they're slow to change and embrace change. So that's kind of what I wanted that scene to show, is that they're still very much an official face of the church that is out of step.
I struggle with this as a Catholic, and I'm curious if you do too. When you have the part of your Catholicism where you go to church on the Sundays and the High Holy Days, you practice your faith, but yet you come into contact with this bureaucracy, and then you find yourself having to take the arrows from people who criticize the church's bureaucracy. Do you have a hard time separating your faith from the bureaucracy of the church?
You know, I do, and I did even more so before this. And this was sort of my epiphany on the whole deal. When we were growing up, or at least I am, I'm probably older than you, there was a thing called the cafeteria Catholic, the a la carte Catholic. And it was used as a pejorative, like, oh, okay, you just pick and choose the things you want out of the Catholic Church. Well, I think more of that's going on, but the paradigm has shifted. And I'm a Catholic in spite of some of their stances. And this kind of was hammered home to me. A guy I wrote about in the book, Bob Berner, is a friend, pushing 90, you know, went to Notre Dame, bunch of kids, always very at peace, you know, has had hardships, and really takes great solace in his faith. And, you know, I was kind of poking and prodding him about it as I was trying to figure my own way out. And he said, you know, you got to remember that we're the church. Me and you and our families are the church. That these guys in Rome or up on the corner parish, they're just, you know, a bureaucracy. They aren't the church. We're the church. And I think that helps me, Brian, is saying, all right, me and you are the church. We don't have to agree with everything. And the faith's more important than the men who are administering it.
As I read through this book, I was amazed, and I hear about this all the time. There's different saints that people are championing the cause for in the United States. Only two Catholic saints were even born in the United States, and there's only about seven what are considered United States saints canonized. Why is it with all the pull of the Catholic Church? I mean, we have Cardinal Dolan in the, basically the American Pope, the Archbishop of New York, the Cardinal there. Why is it so hard to get a United States saint canonized? Because it seems like with the superpower, is it just that we're such still a young country compared to Italy and the rest of the world?
I think there's young, that's part of it, and that's a good question. And basically, half the saints are from Italy, so they basically have a home field advantage. We are a young country. We only had one archbishop up until 1938, and 1908 we were still thought of as a territory by the Vatican, not a full-fledged member. Basically, the fact that the Catholic Church is in good shape here and has a lot of membership and is a cultural force works against us, because they're now employing saints to shore up the faith, and in demographics they're not doing so well. I mean, right now the push is Asia and Africa. Before that it was Latin America. So I think that's part of it. And Father Capon has an interesting case, and you know, he's going to get there, but why there's not a rush for him or Archbishop Fulton Sheen or Father Flanagan is they're mad at the American priests at the Catholic Church because of the sexual abuse scandal. They blame it on us, all right? Second, the fact that Father Capon's a military guy, you know, the way the United States wields its power as a superpower is not popular all the time. And, you know, it's Father Capon appeals to military guys, farmers and rural and the heartland, and you know, does have global reach, but you know, is that enough to move him to the fast top of the line? And we just saw this in recent weeks. A 15-year-old Italian boy was just beatified, which puts him on the doorstep of canonization. He's already got one miracle approved, and his name was Carlos Acutis. He died of leukemia at 15 in 2006, and his virtue I won't diminish, nobody can diminish, but really what he went viral as a tech-savvy computer kid for finding miracles online and validating them. So, you know, he goes further in 13 years because it's good for the church to say, hey, we got a millennial computer-savvy kid, so we're in step with the world. So I think those decisions get made.
And so much of this bureaucracy can be waived by the Pope. He did it with canonization of Pope John Paul II so quickly, right?
Yeah, he did in 9 years, and Mother Teresa in five. And now Pope Francis is letting folks in with just one miracle. The Pope is the guy who can do whatever he wants on this. And, you know, as I discovered and have laid out, they do change and they do evolve. And so, you know, I can see a day where no miracles, just a thing of holiness is enough to get in. So, you know, it's an old bureaucracy, Brian, and nobody knows what they do and why they do it.
Well, I tell you, it was just a fascinating book as a Catholic to read, and I'm sure that non-Catholics alike would love the story. The book is The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith by Joe Drape. The book's available now. It's an absolutely fascinating read. Joe, I thank you for joining us today to talk about this fantastic book.
Brian, I appreciate the opportunity, and have a good holiday. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Now, when the saints marching in, marching in. watching.